Everybody, and welcome to Geek Actually, episode 23 for Friday the 30th of January 2009. Geek Actually is brought to you by listeners like you. Thanks for your donations. It's much appreciated, and we couldn't do the show without you. Now, my name is Dave McVeigh, and I'm your host for the day. It's a slightly different show because I haven't got any guests today. We may have Mirren joining us a little bit later on. She's working to a deadline at the moment, and she can't be with us for the whole show, and she will try and join us for the second half when we get to the film reviews. In the meantime, though, I'm flying solo because Jake is also not with us. He was hopefully going to join us in via Skype today, but he's actually somewhere between Melbourne and Sydney at the moment. He's driving back to Sydney from Melbourne, and he will be on the show next week. And next week, we'll also have a special guest. Katrina Smith is joining us again for next week's show, so that should be a lot of fun as well. In the meantime, we will do the best we can. I will muddle my way through this on my own. So we're going to start off a little bit with a little bit of tech news. And what we're going to start with is Wikipedia. Now, we talked about this last week on the show with Britannica entering the online scene with encyclopedias. And apparently they may have an even bigger foothold now because Wikipedia apparently had some massive inaccuracies and is forcing them to possibly change their way of doing business. According to an article online this week, we had entries on the Internet Encyclopedia Wikipedia may have to be pre-approved after it wrongly claimed that Senator Edward Kennedy had died. Well, Senator Edward Kennedy hasn't died yet. He did collapse during the inauguration of Barack Obama, and he was taken to hospital, but somebody put up onto Wikipedia that he had died. They had also made comments that another politician, Senator Byrd, had also died, and he also hasn't died yet. So this is forcing Wikipedia to... I just got mail. This is forcing Wikipedia to think about their policies about pre-approving articles before they go up. Now, this is a very different turn of events, because Wikipedia works on the concept of user-generated articles. The public are encouraged to provide the entries. And then once they're up, if people find inaccuracies, you can post that. Excuse me while I have a drink of water. So you can put up your corrections and so forth, and it grows from there. But they're now saying that they may have to pre-approve, which will be a little bit more IMDb-ish, it would seem. Now, a story that is very close to my heart, and we have harped on about it for many episodes, but that is the Internet Clean Feed that we've talked about so much here in Australia. Well, an article came out in the Sydney Morning Herald this week that I thought was very interesting. The article was headlined, "Labor's Deafening Silence as Web Censorship Trials Delayed." Yay! All I can say is there was much applauding on that. But apparently what has happened is this. They were supposed to start trials of the clean feed in December. December 6th, actually, was when they were supposed to start, and they haven't started. Now, the last thing I heard was that only two major ISPs had actually signed on to be part of this trial. One of them is iiNet, who's my ISP. And the reason why iiNet was actually joining this was because they wanted to prove it didn't work. Well, they may not have to prove it because it looks like it's not going to go ahead anyway. We'll see what happens. According to this article, it says one of the largest ISPs signed up to participate in Labor's ambitious internet censorship trials has said its application has been met with a deafening silence from the government, raising questions over the workability of the proposed scheme and the effectiveness of the trials. So, Mark White, who's the CEO of iiNet, said that his ISP put in a submission to be part of the December 6th trials, and he was told that the government would come back to him with more details in the middle of January. So that's after the trials are supposed to start anyway. But then he heard nothing. They never got back to him. So we wait and see what happens. Senator Conroy, who started this whole thing in the first place, promised before Labor was elected about this entire thing that it would be an opt-out system. And then after they got elected into office, they proposed this two-tier system. The first tier would be mandatory and would be based on the blacklist. And then the second tier would be the opt-out. Well, this is just ridiculous because it said that they would block illegal. Okay, granted, if you're going to put in a clean feed, then I guess illegal is fair. But then they're also going to block inappropriate material. Now, the inappropriate was the problem, and this has been my problem the whole time. Now, the government this week did actually come out with a statement and say that they had 16 applications from ISPs, so not just two majors. They're saying they had 16 ISPs looking to take part in these trials. But then, for them to actually have this massive silence would actually indicate that these are very small players, and really the numbers aren't enough to make it a viable trial. So we'll see what happens. Now, this blacklist that the mandatory part is supposed to be based on is the part that gets me. The article goes on to actually talk about the fact that the AMA, the ACMA blacklist was mostly child pornography. The government, but the government has now revealed that only 674 sites on the 1,370 sites currently listed on that list are actually child pornography. So 506 sites would be classified R or X rated, and these are legal to view in Australia. So by mandatorily blocking things that are legal to look at in Australia, I think we have a bit of a problem with censorship there. I think it's censorship gone insane. We will keep on top of this, and we will keep reporting more on this. At this point, the trials seem to have been suspended, so we'll see what happens. I'm hoping they just give it up entirely, because it's just a ridiculous, ridiculous thing. All right, now, Sydney Morning Herald also had an article, and this article has actually been going around and round and round, and so we're not going to harp on it because almost every tech podcast out there has covered it already, but I just thought it was funny, and I just thought I'd put to bring it up to my listeners just in case you haven't been listening to the other ones. A New Zealand man who was in Oklahoma went into a charity shop, and he bought himself an MP3 player. Now, when he got home and he had a look at this MP3 player, and as we know, for those who aren't really real heavy techs, you can use a lot of MP3 players as removable hard drives, like thumb drives, like the USB keys. He actually found on this MP3 player 60 U.S. military files, including names and telephone numbers of American soldiers. This is a bit of a concern. TV One News, which I'm assuming is in England TV One, I'm not sure. Anyway, but TV One News said that they reported that the 60 files contained personal details of U.S. soldiers, including some who had served in Afghanistan and Iraq. The U.S. Embassy has declined to comment on this incident, which I think is very funny. And when Ogle, the man's name is Chris Ogle, and he's 29 from North New Zealand, when Ogle offered to hand over the electronic files to the embassy, they basically didn't respond to him. So I think there's a little bit of embarrassment happening here. What's interesting about this is that this is actually not the first time that this has happened. Apparently, in 2006, in the small city, small Afghan city of Bagram, there is a U.S. military base near this city, and apparently shopkeepers in Bagram base said they were selling flash drives with U.S. military information that had been stolen by some 2,000 Afghans employed as cleaners, office staff, and laborers. And I'm sure they weren't trying to sell the military secrets. They were just selling the drives because it's a little bit of extra cash. But these secrets kept floating out there all over the place on these old drives. I think it's about time that people started to use things like TrueCrypt and stuff to encrypt their data. Or, alternatively, don't put stuff on these little thumb drives. It's insane. All right, so that's about all the tech I've got for you today. It's kind of a slow week here, guys. I got to tell you, it's a little bit of a slow week. We could harp on and say that, you know, Steve Jobs is still sick, Windows 7 still hasn't arrived, and iLife 09 has still come out. But we talked about all these things last week. This week we actually have a lot more film news than we have, or film stories, film-related stories, than we do on tech-related stories. So we're going to get straight into this. Okay, some of these stories are really good. Some of them, you know, they're just kind of average. Some of them are very good. We've got award season, as we know. Now, I think it's worth noting that here in Australia, we also have awards. The Oscars are coming soon. We gave our predictions last week. The Film Critics Circle Award nominees have come out. Now, the Film Critics Circle Awards will be presented on Friday, February 13th at Bondi Junction Greater Union. And I decided to run through a couple of these because, I mean, for those who live overseas, you've probably never heard of some of these. But what I think is very amusing is there's probably a lot of Australians that haven't heard of some of these films. So our best film category, and there's one here that's in under foreign films, which I'll get to in a second. But under the best film category, we're not going to go through every single category, but best film category, we've got Australia, obviously. This is the big blockbuster for Australia this year. But we've also got The Black Balloon, Son of a Lion, The Square, and Unfinished Sky. Now, I'd be very curious, you can post comments on the blog when this episode comes out, but I'd be very curious to know how many of you Australians out there have actually seen these five films. I think a lot of you have probably seen Australia because in Australia, here, Australia has actually been quite a big success for an Australian film, but our box office doesn't count for much worldwide. But it's actually turned like $30 million or something like that. So as far as Australia is concerned, Australia is a big hit. Problem is that the film costs so much money that if it doesn't open everywhere else in the world, it will never make its money back. But so I think a lot of Australians have probably seen Australia. But The Black Balloon got quite a lot of critical praise when it came out, but I haven't seen it. In fact, I can honestly say that I have seen one of these five films. A bit shameful, really, but I've seen one. The Square got a lot of critical praise when it came out. But Son of a Lion and Unfinished Sky, I don't even remember these being at the cinema, quite frankly. They were probably shown at the art houses. We've got Best Director, Best Actor. They're the same films again and again and again. What I thought was very interesting on this list, Mirren actually passed this list on to me, so if I'm a little bit rough around the corner on the list, it's possibly because I haven't read the whole thing. But what I thought was very interesting on this list, also it's not very inspiring, but what I thought was very interesting on this list was Best Foreign Film, English Language. They have two categories. They have Best Foreign Language Film and Best Foreign Film, English Language. In the Best Foreign Film, English Language, we've got In Bruges, which I loved. We've got Slumdog Millionaire. We'll come back to that. I'm reviewing that today, which I loved. We've got There Will Be Blood. Now, forgive me, but wasn't There Will Be Blood last year? It was nominated in the Oscars last year. So why is it this year on this award? This is the one that actually got me. I thought that's very odd. And WALL-E. Now, I do appreciate the fact that WALL-E is up there with the other films in that category because I loved WALL-E, and I think it is one of the better films of the year. And in, of course, the Oscars, they have an animated film category, so it'll never actually make it to the best film category. But anyway, so that's the Critics Awards. This is a big year for blockbusters, and we're going to come back to that. I've got an article here from screendaily.com. Mirren's passed on to me, and it's very interesting, some of the big films coming out, and we'll just have a run through that. But first of all, I just want to say that I love this. There is a magazine here in Australia called Zoo Weekly. Now, it's kind of a pseudo-men's magazine. It doesn't have nudity in it, but it's got the bikini girls and stuff like that. And it focuses heavily on sport as well. So it's a little bit like Sports Illustrated, but every issue is the bikini issue. Go figure. Anyway, so in this magazine, Zoo Weekly, this year, they actually released their what they call the top 10 un-Australians of the year, because of course on Australia Day, which was last week, we have an award given out for Australian of the Year. This is the un-Australian of the Year by Zoo Weekly, and I just love some of these people. Now, for those who are overseas, some of these won't be relevant to you, but I'll just read them out. And I love the fact that they're actually, I'm not going to read them all because some of them, they have no relevance, but I love the fact that number one on the un-Australian of the year, and I just can't help it, we can't help bashing it, but is Baz Luhrmann. And Baz Luhrmann has been nominated for the un-Australian of the year for the embarrassment of a film that Australia was. And I just think that's terrific. Also on this list, South Australian Attorney General Michael Atkinson. For those recalling, many episodes ago, we talked about the fact that we can't get an R rating brought in for video games. He is the Attorney General that is holding that up. Kevin Rudd, who is our Prime Minister, has been called the un-Australian of the year for calling a ban to pay rises this year. Okay, very interesting. Banks have become un-Australian of the year, probably because of the financial crisis that everybody thinks we're in. John Howard, our previous Prime Minister, is the un-Australian of the year. New South Wales politician Fred Nile, who is also a very religious person, because he's trying to ban topless bathing on our beaches. I think that's appropriate. Qantas, un-Australian of the year. Qantas is the airline who keep having accidents. It seems they can't seem to keep their planes in the air at the moment. And Queensland Premier Anna Bligh for ordering a crackdown on flashers who stand on balconies during the IndyCar race, which I think is wonderful. So you can see where Zhu's mind is. But I think Baz Luhrmann taking the number one spot is my favorite of the entire list. All right, so I just have another drink of water here. One of the blockbusters that we're going to talk about in a little bit of coming up this year is the new Harry Potter film, which is Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. But what they're doing at the moment is they're also filming Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, which is the last one. And, of course, what they're doing with the last book, because it's such a big book and it's such a big finale, is that they're actually going to split it in half, and they're going to release them 6 months apart. They're going to release Deathly Hallows Part 1 and Deathly Hallows Part 2, which will probably make it the most comprehensive adaptation of the series because they have lots of time to tell their story. I don't think it's particularly necessary, but this is what they want to do. I guess they want to milk it as much as they can. They're coming to the end. What's interesting, though, is that this week, while filming, they actually had a stuntman who got hurt. He was apparently doing a wire work, and he got caught in an explosion, hit the ground pretty hard, and he's been taken to hospital. He was actually Daniel Radcliffe's stunt double. Now, what intrigued me about this article was that if they were shooting any other movie, one of these little low-budget films or something, this wouldn't even make the news. Stunt people get hurt all the time. He isn't dead. He's just been taken to hospital. But, you know, because it's a Harry Potter film, it makes the news. What can I tell you? Now, a couple weeks ago, we actually talked about the fact that Narnia 3, which is the Chronicles of Narnia Voyage of the Dawn Treader, was dropped by Disney. Now, this is fairly big news because Disney basically just said that they didn't want to continue on. This is after the lackluster box office of Prince Caspian. And so they've pulled the plug. So it went into turnaround, and basically Walden Media was shopping around trying to find another production company. Well, it's been picked up. And 20th Century Fox is the studio to do it. They have picked it up, and they are developing it, and they are going to get it into production as fast as possible. Now, what I think is interesting is that Fox is doing this, of course, because they really want a family-friendly, literature-based franchise. And they tried this a couple years ago with Aragorn, and it didn't perform very well, and it was actually a pretty terrible film. So I guess this is their next attempt at trying to make a family-friendly, literary-based franchise. And if they pull it off and they can actually make some money out of it, then we should see the rest of the Narnia films made. Now, I'm hoping that Fox will also improve a little bit, because I enjoy the Narnia films. I thought they were kind of fun. They were kind of like Lord of the Rings light, but I would actually like to see a little bit more work put into them. I think they could be exceptional, and they're not quite exceptional at this point. Okay, a few weeks ago, in fact, late last year, I actually posted on the blog, geekactually.com, that Sylvester Stallone was doing a movie called The Expendables, and I actually headed my blog post, "Is this just Rambo by another name?" Because it was about a mercenary going into South America and blah, 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 blah. Well, apparently it's not. And there was an article on comingsoon.net that actually has a little article about Sylvester Stallone saying that he's not done with Rambo yet. Apparently he is preparing to shoot the action-adventure film The Expendables, but that's not Rambo, but he is planning to play John Rambo again. He says, quote, "Yes, we are. Yeah, we are doing another Rambo, but the conflict is whether to do it in America or a foreign country," said Stallone. Well, you know what? They finished the last film in America, so why not just carry on from the last film? Or, I got a better idea. Let's not do another one. Anyway, the reason why I brought this up was that on Coming Soon, they allow you to post comments, and some of the comments caught my eye, and I quite like some of these comments. So I thought, from that article, we have people saying, this is posted by a person called Oh My God No, or OMG No, and he says, "Seriously? It was a good movie, but let dead dogs lie," which I think is just terrific. And Strange Hero has posted, "I am the law," which, of course, for those who have seen Judge Dredd, you will know that quote. Now, Lorenzo posted, "Yes, just make it a longer flick. The fourth one was like 70 minutes long without credits. I enjoyed the fourth, so bring on the fifth." So I enjoyed it, but really, it needs to be a little bit longer. With the last film, I don't know if it did need to be any longer. It was so grisly gory that I don't know if I could have taken much more of it. I mean, it was an all right film. I didn't mind it. It was just kind of laughable. I'm still pondering whether it makes the list or not. For those who don't know the list, the gloriously wonderful bad list, go to geekactually.com and have a look. These are films that I absolutely adore that are the worst films ever made. Anyway, so, but that's all explained on the website. Now, this person, Mike, has actually written quite a long one. He wrote his synopsis, what he thinks it should be. And he wrote, I think it would be cool to have him finally living in retirement, visits Washington, D.C. to pay his respects to Colonel Troutman and gets caught up in a terrorist attack at the White House. Have Rambo visit on a tour or whatever, and the White House gets taken over. We never thought 9/11 would have happened, but it did, so anything is plausible. Make it as Rambo takes out each terrorist in similar fashion as the first film. Very small but deadly actions. Refrain from all the bloody dismemberment like the last one had. Don't get me wrong, I love that film, but tone it down. Don't have him flying gunships on the White House lawns blowing everything up. At the end, have him die for the president and receive another Medal of Honor, buried at Arlington Cemetery with a huge turnout of military soldiers, basically finishing the series. No, I don't think so. And in fact, somebody actually wrote down here and said, where is it? There's one here that says, I've lost it now. Where is it? It says, anyway, I can't find it now. But basically, in a nutshell, it said, come on, that sounds a little bit like Die Hard 4. So I don't know. I just think Rambo's finished. I think, you know, the last one, he wanted to make a statement about Burma. He did it. It was incredibly gory, but it's done. Let it lie. I think Stallone needs to move on to greener pastures. I liked the last Rocky film. I didn't mind the last Rambo film, but really, come on, let's move on. I like this one here, posted by a person called Nameless, says, stop, or my mom will shoot. So I think that's kind of funny. And the other one that I thought was very funny, and this is my favorite, and in fact, this actually made my lovely, adorable wife go, why hasn't that been done before? It says, to quote the original article, it says, it'll take place in either America or a foreign country. Well, Darth Morbiva, I can't figure out how to pronounce it, Darth Morbiva, I think it is, says, it's good to know that this will take place somewhere within the atmosphere of Earth, and they won't take this series out into space. Well, I hate to tell you, but they actually did ponder Rambo in space at one point during the 90s. So, yes, I'm very glad it stayed on the ground as well. A little bit of trivia. Gene Roddenberry, who died many years ago, his wife, Majel Barrett, we talked about this a couple shows ago, has died in December. Veil to Majel. She and Gene wanted to have their remains put to space, to basically say space, the final frontier, and it looks like they are actually going to get this done. It's because according to this article in news.com.au, the Roddenberrys to go on final Star Trek. It says, ashes of Star Trek creator Gene Roddenberry and his actress wife will blast toward the far reaches of the cosmos in keeping with the show's famed opening line, space, the final frontier. Majel Barrett, who died in December, 2 months before her 77th birthday, and will posthumously fulfill a dream of journeying through space with her husband. A company called Celestis Incorporated, which is a U.S. company, is going to be behind this flight. They've already sent some of Gene Roddenberry's ashes into orbit around the Earth in a Premier Founders Flight rocket launched in 1997. The rest of his ashes are going up with his wife, hopefully, and they will send them up. They're going up in little rifle cartridge-sized canisters and with the remains of others who also want to do this. And they're basically, as it says here, ostensibly being burned into the oblivion as it re-enters the Earth's atmosphere. So it will be shot off into space. Very, very sweet, I think. The other one that caught my attention this week is that John Landis, who I love John Landis. John Landis is a film director. He directed The Blues Brothers. He directed American Werewolf in London, Spies Like Us. I mean, you name it. He's directed a lot of films. And not a person who is unfamiliar with controversy, with the Twilight Zone accident of the early 80s. But in this particular case, this is a wacko jacko story. Apparently, John Landis is suing Michael Jackson. For those who don't know, the very influential music video clip Thriller, which is a 14-minute long short film, basically, and was just mind-blowing in its day, was directed by John Landis and special effects by Rick Baker. Well, apparently John Landis is supposed to be receiving 50% of the profits from Thriller throughout all these years, including licensing rights, etc. And apparently Michael Jackson has not been paying him for at least the last 4 years, because we know Michael Jackson's been under a lot of financial stress. The lawsuit accuses Jackson, who is now 50, of fraudulent, malicious, and oppressive conduct, claiming that Jackson had failed to produce full and proper accounts for the past 4 years and earlier, in quotes. So it'll be interesting to see how that pans out. But John Landis should be getting his fair share. I'm sorry. Jackson is insane. And, you know, fair's fair is all I can say to any of that. All right, so this year is a big year for blockbusters. ScreenDaily.com, Mirren passed this on to me, by the way, and it's a fabulous little article written by Mike Goodridge, basically putting the 2009 Hollywood blockbusters under the spotlight, just saying what's coming out. And it's very interesting to note that some of our big directors are back, some of our big franchises are back, and if you are a fan of big blockbuster cinema, which I am, I have all my notes on paper this week. It's very strange. We've been printing all these articles. Usually I'm referring to a laptop, but this week I'm really, really old-fashioned, very low-tech, so to speak. All right, so we have this year James Cameron, Peter Jackson, Martin Scorsese, all coming back into the fray. We've got the big films, we got the franchises, Harry Potter, Terminator, X-Men, Twilight, these are all coming back in. We've got some other smaller films coming in, so it's very interesting. It's going to be a very interesting year. All right, so we've got Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince coming in July 17th. This was actually delayed. This was supposed to be a Christmas release in 2008, and they've pushed it back to put it right in the heart of the summer season. So I'm not entirely sure what their choices are here. We've got Terminator Salvation, the fourth of the Terminator films. James Cameron light. He's not involved in it. Also Arnold Schwarzenegger light. So it's going to be a first Terminator film with no Schwarzenegger. So it's going to be very interesting to see where this goes. Now, Christian Bale, The Dark Knight, is starring in the film. So it's going to be very interesting to see what they do. Apparently, this is going to be the film that the fans have been waiting for, according to the director, which is the future. So all the other films are about nowadays leading up to this future that we see in flashbacks. Well, apparently Terminator Salvation is set in the future, so it is the war. So we're going to finally get to see lots of robots fighting each other. Wait a minute, that sounds a lot like another film coming out this, which is Transformers Revenge of the Fallen. So we've also got the sequel to Transformers. So we're going to have a year of fighting robots, it would seem. Anyway, all right, so we've got horror films coming out, and we've also got some 3D, let me tell you, because 3D at the moment is the hot gimmick of choice with this new technique that's being done that we talked about last week with Bolt. Fabulous technique. It works very well. I'm going to see a new one actually in a couple weeks. I'm going to go see My Bloody Valentine, which is the remake of the 80s horror film, and it's been done in 3D. We've also got some gigantic super epics going into 3D. We've got Avatar, which is James Cameron's new film, which is a science fiction epic. And we also have a new computer animated film with Reese Witherspoon called Monsters and Aliens. And of course, we're running through this pretty quickly, and we will cover all of these as they start to come out, because we'll review them and so forth. The interesting thing about Avatar, little side geeky thing that I think, because, you know, we like to talk geek, is that James Cameron actually started his own special effects company called Digital Domain, and they were started to do effects for things like True Lies and Titanic, etc. Well, apparently a great chunk of Digital Domain has now been sold off to Michael Bay, who is the current leaseholder, so to speak, and James Cameron is getting the effects work on Avatar to be done by Weta, who is Peter Jackson's company who did Lord of the Rings. So it's a really kind of interesting turnaround. I would have thought that Digital Domain would have been the first port of call for James Cameron, but it would seem not. But then again, what I also find quite amusing is that Transformers, which is a Michael Bay film, is having its effects work done by Industrial Light and Magic. I don't get it. It's all kind of out there. Anyway, so we've got Watchmen coming out. Now, Watchmen is the geek film of geek films this year. I think it's coming out, I believe, in March or April. I think it's March. This is the one that I'm really waiting for. If you've been living under a rock, it's based on a graphic novel by Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons, and it is just brilliant. And I can't wait to see the film, and I'm really hoping they don't screw it up big time. We have another film in the X-Men franchise coming this year, which, of course, is X-Men Origins Wolverine. Now, the trailer is available online. You can go to geekactually.com. We have it being fed onto there as well. It actually looks pretty good, and interestingly enough, shot here in Australia. The list goes on and on. We've got a sequel to Night of the Museum. We have a sequel to Alvin and the Chipmunks. We have... So the Night of the Museum is called Battle of the Smithsonian. Alvin and the Chipmunks is called the Squeakquel, which I think is quite funny. And we have New Moon, the sequel to Twilight. We also have some other blockbusters coming. We've got remakes. The Taking of Pelham 123, which this will actually make it the third remake, I think it is. The second one was actually made for TV. First one, of course, is a wonderful film. Walter Matthau and, I want to say Quint, Robert Shaw. Fabulous film. Real good heist film. This one is apparently starring Denzel Washington and John Travolta. I'm not sure if that's quite the same caliber of casting, but we'll see. We also have an update to The Wolfman, the original Universal horror film. We've got a Wolfman coming out remake. We also have Sherlock Holmes from Guy Ritchie, which we've talked about before. And there are now photos surfacing of Robert Downey Jr. as Sherlock Holmes, and it's got Jude Law as Watson. Robert Zemeckis' new 3D film. Remember a few weeks ago we actually talked, it was right near the beginning, actually. We talked about the fact that Zemeckis has said that he doesn't want to direct live-action films anymore. He is concentrating wholly and solely on motion capture. A couple years ago we had Beowulf, and before that he had Polar Express, and he's developing this motion capture, trying to make it more and more perfect as he goes. Well, he's got another one coming out. This one's called it's called A Christmas Carol, which it is actually a version of The Christmas Carol by Dickens. This one's starring Jim Carrey in seven roles. Now, if you remember, back when he did Polar Express, Tom Hanks did most of the roles. This time he's got Jim Carrey producing most of the roles, which I think is quite funny. So that could be interesting to have a look at. Now, each one of his motion capture films is getting better. Polar Express, and we're not talking about the story or the acting. We're talking about the technology. Now, in the Polar Express, the one big criticism he had was that all the characters had really dead eyes. In Beowulf, they have done a lot of work to make that better, and it wasn't 100%, but on the most part, it was better. So we'll see. Christmas Carol, let's see him develop that technology even further. Okay, we have Pixar making another offering this year, which is a film called Up, which is supposed to be opening in May. And what else have we got? Let's have a look here. We've got He's Just Not That Into You, based on the book. The thing about that film, which I think is interesting, is that it's got a huge, huge cast. Now, we've got in this film Jennifer Aniston, Scarlett Johansson, Drew Barrymore, and Ben Affleck, and there are others as well. Now, the last time we had a great big ensemble film like this with this huge power cast was The Women, which is now, as we know, nominated for Razzies. So, jury is out. We have some star vehicles coming up this year. Eddie Murphy is coming out in a new family comedy, God Help Us. The last time was Norbit. So he's coming out with a comedy called Imagine That. Dwayne Johnson is coming out in another star vehicle called The Tooth Fairy. God, I hope that's not a children's film. Please let that be something different. John Travolta and Robin Williams are teaming up for a film called Old Dogs. And what else we got? We've got PJ Hogan's new film starring Isla Fisher, Confessions of a Shopaholic. So it's a huge year. I think that the thing that we can take away from this article is that it's just an absolutely huge year for films. And of course, just in case you were wondering, the Jonas Brothers, the 3D concert experience, is also coming out. Oh my God, I will be avoiding that. That was like when Miley came out with her film. All right. Now, I've got three films to review. I mean, I've been busy this week. I've had to play some real catch-up. And I'm going to start this by playing you just a little bit of The Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
Promise me he has a place. You never know who's coming for you.
Go back for a moment. Take your mind off things. What in God's name?
infirmities not of a newborn, but of a man well in his 80s on his way to the grave.
He's died?
Of old age.
Oh, God in heaven. He looks just like my ex-husband.
My name is Benjamin. Benjamin Button.
How old are you?
7. But I look a lot older.
God bless you. He's 7.
Benjamin, this is my granddaughter, Daisy.
Are you sick?
They said I was going to die soon, but maybe not.
You're odd.
You got your...
I really enjoyed this film, I've got to say. I went into this film thinking that it's going to be dreadful. No, I hate to say it, but it just... From the trailers and everything, it just felt really earnest, and I was just a little bit concerned that it was going to be a little bit saccharine-y, but I quite enjoyed it. It's very fable-like. The story, basically, for those who haven't seen, I know this film is a little bit late in our reviews. It actually opened a few weeks ago, but the film is a fable about a man who was born old, and as the film goes forward, he actually gets younger. And it's his adventures through life. Brad Pitt puts in a wonderful performance as Benjamin, and the technology behind this film is phenomenal. Now, David Fincher, the director, is no stranger to digital playing around and effects. I mean, this is the man who had that wonderful opening shot in Panic Room where the camera pulls back and goes through the handle of the coffee pot. He likes playing, and he's pulled his entire arsenal of tricks together for this film because... they didn't do the aging of Benjamin the traditional way with lots of makeup. They actually did it with digital effects work. They had a small person who wore blue headgear, and they had motion capture of Brad Pitt. And then they created a 3D model of this aged head, which they then matched up to the body. And it's fabulous. I mean, the effects work is seamless. It's just perfect. And once again, we were talking about digital domain. This is digital domain's work. And it's excellent, excellent, excellent work. The film fails in a couple of things. It is a little long-winded to get where it's going. It is a little... for those who don't enjoy a bit of a fable, you may have some trouble with some of the plot holes throughout it. But on the most part, it works very nicely. In fact, I watched a lot of this film with my lovely wife, and she actually pointed out that it's very Forrest Gumpish in that quality of the film that it is, in that fable kind of aspect of it. And it is. It's got that kind of... He kind of moves through life and things just happen around him, and he just kind of watches and observes everything that's going around him while he is getting younger. I enjoyed this film a lot. David Fincher, when he first started out as a director, he was a... we mustn't forget that he was actually a director of television commercials. And his first film... his first feature film, I absolutely and utterly hated at the time. My opinion's changed a little bit now with time passing, but he directed Alien 3 as his first feature film, and it was awful. But he redeemed himself in 1995 with the film Seven. Now, Seven was sensational, and he followed that up with The Game, and of course he directed Fight Club, and I think he is fast turning into one of my favorite directors. He's a unique vision. He doesn't always quite hit the mark. Panic Room didn't quite hit the mark. I didn't like the ending of The Game. I liked the film all the way up to the end, and I haven't seen Zodiac yet, and there's going to be people out there going, what? Why haven't you seen Zodiac? Well, I haven't had a chance. I will get to it, but Benjamin Button was good. I liked it. It's been nominated for a lot of Oscars. Do I think it deserves them all? It deserves some of them. But there is another film this year, which we are going to talk about in just a few minutes, which really does deserve all of the Oscars. And we will talk about that in just a few minutes. We'll come back to that one. But overall, I enjoyed Benjamin Button a lot. I don't think it's a perfect film. And I think it does have some issues. I love the way it's photographed in this kind of sepia color. It's really nice with that old kind of feel to it. And I love the fact that the photography technique changes throughout the decades. And I think that's really nice. I love the present stuff, which is with Julia Ormond, where she's reading the diary. And I like her reactions to some of the material that she's reading. For those who don't know, the film is actually told in a flashback narrative. Julie Ormond is with her mother in the hospital as she is dying, and she's reading Benjamin Button's diary aloud to her mother. And as she's reading it, we move into these flashbacks that show Benjamin's life. And it's really charming. It's a very charming film, and I do recommend it. It is a nice film. It's not for everybody's taste, but I did enjoy it. The film that I think is going to absolutely and utterly destroy the Oscars this year is Slumdog Millionaire. Now, I saw Slumdog Millionaire. This has just opened at the cinemas here in America. Of course, you had it a few weeks ago. But Slumdog Millionaire is fabulous. And here's a clip from it.
Time for a commercial break, ladies and gentlemen. I know. I can't stand the tension either. We'll be right back.
Guy from the slums becomes a millionaire overnight. You know who's the only other person who's done that? Me. I know what it feels like. I know what you've been through.
I'm not going to become a millionaire. I don't know the answer.
You've said that before, yeah.
No, really. This time I don't.
Come on, you can't take the money and run now. You're on the edge of history, kid.
I don't see what else I can do.
Maybe it's written, my friend. I don't know. I just get some kind of guarded feeling. You're gonna win this. Trust me, Jamal. You're gonna win.
Okay, this film is my prediction for the Oscars. I think this film is going to slam dunk everything. It is going to destroy the competition. This is the feel-good film of the year. Now, it's odd to say that because it's actually quite a harsh film in places, but the overall feeling that it leaves you with at the end is just joyous. Now, for those who don't know, the film is basically about a young man, Jamal, who plays Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, the game show. He goes on the show, and he's winning. He actually becomes a millionaire, and he gets to the last question and is promptly arrested because they think he's cheating. And he then has to explain how he knows the answers to these questions. And the reason why they think he's cheating is because he is a slum dog. He's from the slums of India, and the belief is that he just couldn't possibly know all of these answers because he's just a peasant. And so he's taken in, and the film is told once again in flashback form, which is kind of like the Benjamin Button from before, but it's told in flashback where as they go through each question from Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, he has to explain to the police officer how he knew the answer. And the way they do this is they cut to flashbacks throughout his life, from childhood all the way to now, about his life's experiences and how he learned all these questions through his life experiences. And it is terrific. And each of the kids, because there's him and his brother and this girl, are actually played by three different actors throughout the course of their lives. So very young, middle, and then to the modern time. And each of the casting is perfect on all of them. I mean, it's just sensational. The film is funny, dramatic. It is, you know, it's a bit brutal in places because, I mean, the film opens with him being tortured because they're trying to get the answers out of him as to why or how he knows about this. But I don't want to spoil anything, but the eventual conclusion will just have you cheering. It's just beautiful. The film is stunning to look at. The photography is just magnificent. The soundtrack is magnificent. The locations, the Indian locations, because it's all set in India, are just magnificent. I mean, the film is just works on every single factor. Now, the thing about this film that really got me, and how you know it's a good film, is the fact that it had me thinking about it for 2 days after I saw it. I was running scenes of the film through my head. You know, just it makes me really want to watch the film again. I'm going to have to go to cinema and see it again. It is just fantastic, and it is going to sweep the awards. Mark my words. Now, Danny Boyle, who directed this film, he's a fascinating character in himself. Now, Danny Boyle kind of just rose to meteoric stardom many years ago when he directed the film Shallow Grave with Ewan McGregor, because here is a film that for the first half feels like a comedy, and you sit there and you're kind of laughing along with them, and you know, the roommates and everything else, and then halfway through the film it turns into this deep serious thriller, quite hard-edged, and seamlessly makes this transition. It's a very hard thing to do, and he did it very well. He followed this up with Trainspotting, which was just a fantastic piece of drama. But what really strikes me about Danny Boyle is the fact that he never seems to repeat himself. If you look at it, you go from Shallow Grave, thriller, to Trainspotting, drama, to A Lifeless Ordinary, which is very fairy tale-ish almost, to The Beach, which is very commercial cinema, to 28 Days Later, where we've got zombies and horror, and then Sunshine, which is a science fiction epic. So, and now Slumdog Millionaire, which is this Indian drama. He is an amazing director in the sense that he just seamlessly kind of slides from one genre to another without really missing a beat. And of course, he made the children's film Millions a couple of years ago. So he really is a remarkable young director, and I watch very carefully to see what he comes out with next. I love Slumdog Millionaire. I thought this was, I think, probably his most assured film to date. I think this is his best work. And I think he's been building to this moment. And I think this is why he deserves all the Oscars. I think last week we did some predictions. I think this week I'm quite ready to say, without a shadow of a doubt, that I think, and if I'm wrong, that's fine, but I think that there's a couple of categories that I can say without a doubt, which I think will win. I think Best Picture and Best Director will go to Slumdog. No doubt in my mind. I think Best Music, Best Cinematography, and Best Original Song will also go to Slumdog Millionaire. I think Best Actor is going to go to Mickey Rourke for The Wrestler. I think that Best Animated Film will go to Wall-E, and I think Best Visual Effects will go to Benjamin Button. I think Best Makeup, however, will go to Hellboy. And I know that sounds very odd, because Hellboy 2 is such an underdog, but out of the three films that are nominated, it is the true makeup film of those films. Benjamin Button is also nominated, and so is Dark Knight. But Dark Knight, I mean, really, there's the Harvey Dent Two-Face stuff, but when you think about it, Harvey Dent Two-Face mostly is digital. And when you think about the Joker, it's a fabulous makeup job, but it's very subtle. When you look at Benjamin Button, you've got people aging, yes, but most of the really astounding work is Benjamin himself. Now, in this particular case, a lot of it is digital. With Hellboy, we're talking about real old-fashioned makeup work. And in fact, if you watch the special features on Hellboy 2, you'll actually see that they went out of their way to make as much stuff practical as they could. The last time a film was this kind of a makeup film was the film Legend, and Rob Bottin did win the Academy Award for Legend. So I think it's going to go to Hellboy. More predictions as we have future episodes. Oh my God, Mirren has joined me in the studio. We'll just have to fire up a mic for her. Let's have a look here. I'll fire up a mic for you.
Are you talking boring geek things?
No, we're actually reviewing films right now. Oh. I've finished all the geek news. I finished all the film news.
Oh, that's a good thing.
Hi. How's your deadline going? You going to make it?
I don't know. I'm just, my brain hurt. My finger hurts.
I was just saying to everybody out there that we've got Jake somewhere lost between Melbourne and Sydney in his car. And we've got you meeting a deadline. And here I am trying my best to keep it all going.
And did you tell him that Jake is running away from the heat because there's... We're having a heat wave,
a tropical heat wave.
Well, we were hot last week, but this week it's Adelaide and Melbourne, and they're up to, oh my God, 45 degrees.
They've been actually 40 degrees all week. It's been stunning.
Yeah, they're just pussies. I come from L.A., you know, L.A., 112, we're just getting started, you know. I mean, I just don't, over here, they just get hysterical about the weather. For those of you that don't know, Australians have three topics of conversation. It's on their news and everything. One is the weather. First, sports.
Yep.
Any sports you've got, they'll take. Weather. And then what do they call statistics? You know, how many people got killed on the roads.
Road tolls. They love the road tolls. Like, I just want to run a couple things past you because I was reading them off to the listeners, but I'm not entirely sure what some of the relevance was, unless it was just because we were reading them off. So I got the one about Wikipedia. Yeah, we did that. We did that's one of mine, so that's all right. But that's one of mine, so that's all right. Sorry, people out there. I'm just now, you gave me the Film Critics Circle Awards. Was it just to talk about the nominations or?
Well, yeah, because it's fairly interesting that the Australians have these various awards that nobody knows who's voting or how or anything like it. And when I say that, I'm not exaggerating. I remember talking to the new head several years ago of one of the biggest award ceremonies, which is called the AFIs, the Australian Film Institute, not to be confused with the American Film Institute. And I said, nobody understands the voting system or who gets to vote or anything like that. He says, oh, really? I said, do you understand it? This is the new head guy. I'll bring it up at the first meeting. We'll talk about it. It's like, oh, okay, cool. So nobody knows. So this is their Film Critics Award. As we know, the critics here annoy me too because half the time the critics don't have any background. One of our biggest critics in Melbourne for many years had come from sports reporting, and they promoted him to film.
Gillette, wasn't it? Neil Gillette.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
I thought that was the sports background guy.
No. Anyway, whatever. Years ago.
Whatever his name was.
And so I was trying to be, you know, political and not nice.
Stuffed.
Anyway, so. Anyway, so yes,
I need you to come in and rock the boat. I've been boring this whole show. Come on.
Well, the interesting thing about this that I printed it up for is because we still keep trying to, you know, not us, but people involved with Australia, the movie, and Baz Luhrmann in particular, keep trying to, it is a good movie, it is a good movie. So they've printed this thing saying that even though the Americans didn't like Australia.
I went through that part, yeah.
Okay, well, so they've nominated it for Best Picture. So you'll see the five Best Picture
The funny
awards.
Thing is, in Australia, this is one of the things I was talking about when I actually went through this list with earlier on, was that in Australia, the film has been a hit, but our box office
isn't. I haven't met anybody who's seen it. But
yeah, but it's like McDonald's, though. They all deny eating it, but they all obviously eat it. Because the film has turned $30 million in this country, and for Australia, that's good box office. It's done box office here, but a problem is we don't have the box office to support a film like this. If it can't open in the rest of the world, there's no point in making it.
And the thing is that also a really, really good film also leaves an impact, and this film has made no impact. It's come, it's gone, it's like, what? And but the interesting thing, if you look at that list, it's five nominees for Best Film.
And the point I made about that, before you go on, the point I've already made was the fact that out of these five films, I've only heard of three of them, and I've only seen one of them.
Yeah, well, I've heard of them. I don't usually see Australian stuff, but I've heard of them. But have a look at the Directors Awards nominees.
Black Balloon, Unfinished Sky, The Square. So, yeah, they're all there. There's only four of them.
Four.
I didn't even notice that.
Didn't nominate Baz Luhrmann.
But why are there only four?
Exactly.
And then the Best Actress is only three.
Exactly.
But Best Actress has four. Okay. Now I see what. So, now the thing I loved about this list, and the point that I made out before, was the fact that There Will Be Blood is on here for Best Foreign Film English Language. That's last year's film. That was in last year's Academy Awards. It's in the wrong year.
And the fact that they put their animation together with their regular. So Wall-E's there. I know we disagree on that, but I'm sorry.
I think Wall-E should be nominated as the best film for this year. I think it was a great film.
You can't compare an animated film with a real film.
Of course
film.
You can. Film's a film. Although I did like to point out that Not Quite Hollywood was nominated for Best Documentary Feature, along with Celebrity, Dominic Dunn, which I think is very interesting.
Not Quite Hollywood was far better.
Absolutely, Not Quite Hollywood is Celebrity. The film. Oh, Salute, directed by your favorite person. Mm. Okay. Not Quite Hollywood is by far. And it's funny, here it is nominated as one of the best films, best documentary, and yet nobody saw it. The film died at the box office.
What, Celebrity or Not Quite Hollywood?
Yeah,
well, I know. Because we didn't embrace it here.
I know. It's unbelievable. Ridiculous. We talk about our own film history. I went through that, so that's okay. I went through that. These are all my stories. There was another one from you, I think. No, I think I covered it. Oh, the Screen Daily. That's right. The Screen Daily about the blockbusters. We went through it. We talked about all the big upcoming blockbusters.
Oh, that's
films.
All the stuff that's coming up next year.
Yeah,
which got me thinking about how I think I've solved their problem.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, I think that the problem with right now with the movie industry is that they're going, we don't know what to do. We just keep doing sequels, prequels, whatever. We're creatively bankrupt. we're nervous there might be an actor strike. We just don't know what to do. I was thinking what they ought to do is they ought to, you know, we've got these great spreadsheets and all these things that we can do things on. Why don't they take all the movies for the last, let's say, I don't know, 80 since talkies.
Right,
since,
okay.
And let's have an alphabetical list, right? Now, what we do is we have an alphabetical list of the movies that did really well, mm-hmm. right? And then we have a list of possible actors on this side. And then and we'll do it in
like a deck of cards, just shuffle them
that's
together.
That's right, in year order. So that we're okay, now we're going to do the 1940s, now the 1950s, now the 1960s. And then I was thinking, what fun you would have thinking, you know, people say you can't remake Casablanca and stuff. But my God, you come to Casablanca and go, you know, Tommy Lee Jones with his world-weary face and Catherine Zeta-Jones. You know, people like this. Oh, and they're two Jones, aren't they? I was just thinking, you know, you could have such fun, and even more so, you could open up contests and get people to put in their casting. I just think there's ways that we could open this up and bring it to the people.
Look, I am, quite frankly, I have come to the conclusion after the episode before last, that nothing is untouchable. You could remake anything. If they could remake Day the Earth Stood Still, they can remake anything.
Oh, but it's become so ridiculous that I think that now it's time for them to... it's too haphazard now. I think they need to organize it.
According to this list, it's got they're remaking The Taking of Pelham 1, 2, 3, which I talked about just before. This is the third remake of this film.
Oh, my God.
And what I loved... see if I can find it again. I was looking through the list. There it is, Taking of Pelham 1, 2, 3. Tony Scott's remaking. It's right there, you know, quality filmmaking, right? But what I love is the fact the original starred Walter Matthau and Robert Shaw, right? Mm. I mean, you know, power cast, right? And the new one's going to star Denzel Washington and John Travolta.
Unless it does a Dallas and never gets done.
Well, there is that. I
mean, the other thing that fascinates me is why don't they try doing in reverse? You know, we've done a lot of these things. What are they? You'll help me out. What they're called? The thing that where it looks like it's a cartoon, but it's not a cartoon. I
mean, motion capture and stuff.
Well, no. With Robert Downey Jr.
Oh, things like Waking Life and the one that Scanner Darkly.
The rotoscoping. So why don't we take one that was made normally and then make it in one of those type of things, or animated or something, you know?
Don't give them any ideas.
I know! I should be hired as an ideas person.
I have to share this with you. I've already actually read this to the listeners, and they're going to sit there and go, what the hell are you doing this story for again? We're not doing the whole story. I just need to share, because Mirren was supposed to be here, and she wasn't. And I thought she would get a kick out of some of these. Sylvester Stallone, apparently, is going to inflict us with another Rambo film. No, but what I loved were some of the comments. This is the comments field at the end of the article on coming soon. And some of the comments I thought were very cute. This one just says, seriously? It was a good movie, but let dead dogs lie. You know?
God, please.
But the one I loved, and this is the one that actually made Katie, my beloved wife, stand up and basically say, why haven't they done that?
Really?
Because, you know, it just seemed like an obvious... And I had to explain to her that in the 90s, they actually did toy with this idea. But it's one of those situations like that where you say, don't give them any ideas. This person says, in the article, it actually says... to quote, yeah, we are doing another Rambo, but the conflict is whether to do it in America or a foreign country, said Stallone.
Mm-hmm.
This person has written in response to that statement, it's good to know that this will take place somewhere within the atmosphere of Earth, and they won't take the series out into space.
How long can he keep taking those steroids? How long... He's got to give it up.
It is really just ridiculous.
But here's my question. You know what? When you think of the Seagals and the Jean-Claudes and all that, where's our next crop? Because Gerard Butler and Jason Statham stuff, they aren't
No, because our new crop, we are actually experiencing the new crop right now, but we've gone a different direction. We're not going for the macho, muscle-bound meatheads anymore. We're going for people who can actually act.
Oh.
First stage, and actually have a sense of humor. So
Steven has a sense of humor.
But you look at it, Gerard Butler in Rock and Roller is fabulous, you know? And Jason Statham in the Transporter films with his laconicness is hysterical.
Yeah, he is.
You know? I got to say, Jason Statham is fabulous in The Bank Job, which came out last year.
So what you're saying is, like the era of the supermodels in the 80s, the superheroes like that, the bodybuilders and well...
Yeah, we've moved. We seem to have moved past that.
Yeah.
And we're moving into... into a new generation of action hero.
Because I haven't even seen a lot of action. It's Jackie Chan, Jet Li, and stuff. The martial arts people seem to be dying out, too.
They're still doing stuff. What was it, Forbidden Kingdom or something? Jackie Chan had that film with Jet Li. Funnily enough, they co-starred in it.
I know, but I mean,
and it kind of came and went without a whimper. But
heard it here first. We're entering a new phase with the funny, laconic...
Sensitive New Age
super killers.
You're okay. Just in time because we've got one more film review, and this is one you've seen.
Oh, what?
So I'm going to play a clip for it here. So have a listen to this, and then you can tell us what you think of it, okay?
Good evening. I shall resign the presidency at noon tomorrow.
This is an historic day, the only time a president has ever resigned from office.
Nixon knew about the Watergate cover-up.
The man who has committed the greatest felony in American history will never stand trial.
I've had an idea for an interview, Richard Nixon.
You're a talk show host.
I spent yesterday watching you interview the Bee Gees.
When they terrific.
Why would I want to talk to David Frost?
I got $500,000.
Really?
All right.
Yeah, I'm not the right person to talk to about this because I think every time they do something that was from the history that you lived through, it's hard for me. I don't know how it is for the others to feel that way. But my first thing is, you know, how much do they look like them and how much do they blah, 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 blah. And,
before we go any further, maybe we should tell the listeners that the film is called Frost Nixon.
Oh. Well, if they don't know, where have they been?
All right, so the film is called Frost Nixon, and it basically is a dramatization of an event that took place several weeks after Nixon resigned. David Frost got a bee in his bonnet that he decided that it would be absolutely brilliant to be the sole interviewer of Nixon and really get it out of him. The trick was, at the time, Frost's...
Reputation
was kind of in a bit of flux at that time. Now, we all remember David Frost as being this power person, blah, blah, blah. But it seemed that there was a little bit of a period of time in the 70s where he kind of was lost in the wilderness.
Which, you see, actually, I don't remember, which is interesting, because I remember
because he was lost in the wilderness.
Well, I know, because he was such a high-profile person,
but see,
because that was the week that was, which nobody remembers.
I know, but here's a very interesting point for you.
It was all political.
Yeah, but here's a very interesting point for you, though. At the time that he was lost in the wilderness, we wouldn't have noticed, because where was he?
He was...
in Australia. And we were here. He was actually hosting a show called Frost Down Under. And so we were always surrounded by
Frost. Yeah, that was in 72 or whatever.
No, but he was doing that show when he came up with the Nixon thing.
Yeah, but I'm saying that was like 70,
so,
71.
Okay.
We were here, and I knew him very well.
Also, that's another factor as well, is that by the time we were in Australia... And really, because remember, in America, Frost wasn't as big.
No, he was. I don't remember him from the Frost Australia thing. I remember him from the Frost Report. The Frost Report, and that was the week that was. And so, and I just think, or maybe the Frost, I have to look at it, maybe the Frost Report was after all this happened. Because I just knew him as a guy who was very high profile. I know he was more high profile in Australia than he was in America, of course, because of the English thing. It's always that way when they're high profile in England. But I guess they're accurate in saying that he didn't have this, you know, profile of anything but a talk show host. But I just didn't remember that way. But that's a minor thing.
All right, well, let's
the bigger problem for me was the casting. You
okay,
know, well,
let's have a look at the film from a film's point of view first, and then we'll have a look at it from its accuracy point of view. First of all, the film is basically David Frost secures the rights to interview Nixon. He's basically a talk show host. People don't think that he has what it takes to do this kind of interview. He's insistent that he does. He takes on the thing. He sits down and over a course of several days interviews Nixon to the point where he basically gets a confession. And
yes,
it was an astounding moment. And the actual original Frost Nixon interviews are now available on DVD. And if you want to go back and see the real thing, you can. The film, I thought, from just a film's point of view, was really entertaining. I thought the supporting cast was fabulous. Oliver Platt and Sam Rockwell as his two resource guys were just terrific. His producer, which I can't remember his name, but the guy who plays his producer was really good. And I really like Frank Langella.
Kevin Bacon as Nixon's
aide. And Kevin Bacon as Nixon's aide. But I thought Frank Langella as Nixon was very good. But we have a problem with timeline. Because if you look at the real Frost tapes, Nixon wasn't old and decrepit at the time that these interviews took place. He was only a few weeks out of office.
That's my problem with all the... I didn't like the casting. I know I like Frank Langella. It's hard for me to believe that he's doing things like this now when he started out as a bit of a sex symbol being Dracula. I liked the guy... What's his name? Michael Sheen. Michael Sheen. I liked him better as Blair.
I thought he was fabulous as Blair, as the Queen.
In the Queen. I liked him better as that. I saw David Frost a lot because I watched That Was the Week That Was every week. It was one of our first satirical shows out of England. And I just really loved it. And he had a very mesmerizing way of speaking that was almost a bit like a Margaret Thatcher put-on thing. It was very, very...
Oh, he's very posh.
And very, very posh. And he didn't... And he wasn't as weedy as Michael Sheen. Since it was a movie based around these two people talking most of the time, I spent a lot of my time going, now this is the thing about movies. Movies are very personal. And there are people who like, they like to critique the boxes, you know, the cinematography and the script and the this and that. I always go for what I see, what I hear, what I feel with it. And I just ended up getting a bit annoyed thinking that isn't Frost. And because I have to suspend belief with it. And to me, Langella was, it really wasn't. I mean, I knew Nixon so well. Yeah. I went to Richard M. Nixon Primary School in Yorba Linda when we lived there for a while. And that's a bit of trivia for you. I was 9 years old and my family, my brothers and sisters, and we were the only ones wearing JFK for President buttons at the...
Well, that would have made you popular.
Oh, yes. It was quite interesting. And I always hated Nixon, could never stand him, looked at him and thought, can't people see that this guy's a crook? And we left in 1969 because he was elected in 1968. Yep. And that was one of the things to really push me to get out of there. I said, well, I couldn't live in it.
It's been how I felt about the George W. Bush years.
Well, exactly. And I just never understood why anyone thought anything about Nixon. And the thing is, this movie gives you a feeling this guy is decrepit and blah, blah. And Nixon went on for years after this to be this big ambassador to China and the big China experts. It wasn't entirely accurate. And Langella just, to me, overplayed a bit. I like his physicality, which was very Nixon.
If he was playing Nixon later in his life, because that's what it felt like.
It felt like
a geriatric Nixon who was kind of going a little bit senile and this and that. But unfortunately, that wasn't the period
of
time.
And if anybody thinks I'm wrong, all you have to do is go straight to YouTube because they're there. The Frost-Nixon interviews are there. Frost is there on That Was the Week That Was, and his Frost Report. And
factually accurate point of view of the portrayals, I think the film isn't 100%.
What it revolves around. Yeah, and Langella has been nominated for an Oscar.
I look at films like this and Milk that we reviewed last week, and I look at it and go, there is a whole generation of people out there who don't watch documentaries. I love documentaries, and there's a whole generation who don't watch documentaries, who don't have any historical... I mean, your daughter is a prime example, who, you know, you say this used to be a Beatles song. Who are the Beatles?
Yeah.
You know? So, no offense, Sarah. But, you know, and so there's a whole generation. Now, I think that if you can get information like this, because it was a phenomenal moment, if you can get information like this to that generation to make them interested enough to then go back and look at the real situation, then the film has actually served a purpose.
And sometimes
you've got to make the film, you've got to play the entertainment value more than the fact.
And you know, the interesting thing is, I don't think it would, because what are the figures on it? I don't know, but it seems to me...
I haven't actually looked up the figures on it.
It seems to me that, you know, compared to what's been going on in America for the last 8 years in particular, not to mention other times since Nixon, it's almost like... he did what? Oh, he illegally did this and this and this. Oh, yeah, really? And so what?
Well, his crimes seem pretty fucking minor now.
Well, exactly. He didn't pull him into a world, practically a, you know, world war verge of. I mean, I don't know. I just found that everybody was so shocked at the time because it hadn't happened before. I mean, when they were shocked at Clinton getting blowjobs in the office, well, now we know that Kennedy was having women in the White House all the time, and we've become and that Roosevelt Franklin had a long term mistress and all that. What I'm saying is that we look back. There comes a point, I think, in history where you look at it and you go, really maybe the time has passed for the moment to do that because the shock value is gone to a certain. It's like if you're trying to do Roosevelt had a mistress and
interesting.
Yeah, about, I don't know.
Interesting thing about Frost Nixon is that I think it's probably going to be one of those
What's
sort of films.
What's the market?
I'm about to tell you because you're going to laugh at this. But one of the things about Frost Nixon, I think, is it's going to be one of those films that hangs around for a while. I think it's going to be one of those films for years people are going to say, "Oh, by the way, have you seen this?" In its initial release, it's one of those films that's a critical darling. It's not a box office darling. The film cost $25 million to make. It has taken worldwide so far. It's been out and released now for 8 weeks. That's the big factor. It's taken worldwide a total of $15 million.
Well, because I ask, you know, what's the market? I mean, we know the biggest market in movies is like 18 to... You know, well, something puts up to 35 now and
that
stuff.
Really makes me wonder.
But and I wonder. I ask myself, okay, you know, we're making all these documentary style films, trying to make history palatable to people. And for me, I'm looking at it and going, I think you have to choose your event very carefully.
Because I was about to say, the other historical biopic we've got is Milk, that we talked about last week. And Milk's been in release for 65 days, same time. So it's been in the same time frame. And it cost $20 million to make, and it's taken a worldwide staggering total of $24 million. So the historical films aren't...
No, because the thing is...
When you compare that to Slumdog, let's say, which is the darling at the moment... And actually, that's a very interesting question with Slumdog as to how much money has actually made. I mean, everybody's raving about it, but has anybody actually seen it is the big question. Oh, okay, so Slumdog cost $15 million to make... Looks a lot more. Cost $15 million. It's taken $88 million around the world.
Okay,
so.
See, here's my argument. I mean, we all know that big girls don't cry or big boys don't cry. I was getting this, Hillary Swank.
Boys don't cry.
You know, which is a similar thing.
Hey, big boy.
Gay bashing, killing of gay. You know, blah 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 blah. All I'm saying is that, yes, it was a terrible thing with the Milk thing that happened. But as I said to you, because it was what we did is we went, okay, here was a bit of the history, and then at the end he got killed and didn't make anything of the killing, really, as horrific as it was.
Well, that was kind of like the punchline. It wasn't really the film.
Exactly, which I just don't think today's audience, they're jaded. They're like, you would have been better off to, I know it sounds like a terribly cynical thing to say, but you would have been better off to make the murders gruesome, to make a Matthew Shepard type thing. For those of you who don't know Matthew Shepard, the guy who was crucified and beaten to a pulp. Because, and we do need to point out that the gay thing is still the gay thing.
That's true.
Bigotry is still with us, but we need to make it darker.
That's true, because with Milk, they almost make it feel like, well, he did it, so now everything's better. But, and it's not real.
And it isn't. Mm-hmm. No, I'm sorry. There's still, I mean, hello, Prop 8 didn't pass. Things are going backwards. We still got the moral right still trying to say homosexuality. We still, at this moment, we have Ted Haggard yet again saying with his wife on Oprah that he's trying very hard to cast out the sin of homosexuality.
Oh,
blah, blah, right. blah, blah. So all I'm right. just saying, I think... I think filmmakers at the moment, I still keep coming back to this, have a problem with what to make because one of the first things you've got to do, and nobody wants to admit this, but it's show business, you've got to look at the market as it is, and then that's called, and reflect what's out there at the moment. To project, which is real art, you reflect and you project, that's real art. Take us a step further, you're going to have to take into consideration your crowd, your market, your all, whether you like it or not. You're going to have to, I'm not saying you have to make it a totally cynical paint-by-numbers exercise, but you're going to have to, like, I didn't like Titanic, as you know. Well, I'm the only person in the world that didn't like it.
There are actually people who don't like Titanic.
Okay, but what James Cameron did with it was so brilliant because... You know, to have him sliding off the the raft into the water was the only way you could go to make it a tragic melodrama, you know, where she survives and blows the whistle. You know, I mean, I'm just saying that think about it. If he had held on and lived and they got together and there was a happy ending.
Well, it wouldn't have been a film.
Well, it would not have been the same. It's like Twilight as the books go on. I haven't read them all, but I've dipped into them, and I've had people tell me about how basically horrendous Twilight gets. And I'm sorry, kids are dark. You know, they like it. So I just think that I have a feeling there seems to be a little bit of a chasm between who's making the films and who's watching the film. Ergo, Judd Apatow is a genius at the top of the pile because he knows both how to make a film that reflects and projects as well as understand what his audience wants. And I think that we could do a lot worse than look at Judd.
But I would also say that everything goes in waves. Judd Apatow is going to reach a point where it's saturation.
Oh, absolutely.
And it'll move into something else.
He may not be able to make proper adult films.
It'll be interesting to see if he's actually making this horror movie that he says he's
making. Well, yeah, exactly. But anyway, I think
going back to Frost Nixon, I think Frost Nixon is an enjoyable film. I think that there's no problem with actually sitting down and watching it and going, if as long as you disengage that part of you that's going, did that really happen? Did that really happen? Yeah. Is that really the person? If you can just watch it for the film's point of view of this moment in time, I think it's actually a very interesting film. It's got some really nice interplay between Michael Sheen and Frank Langella.
I guess my question to you is, and think about this one. You know, I do this with films in general. Why? Why was it made? When I could just go watch a doco, or I could go to YouTube, I know the story.
Well, I actually have a feeling it was made because some executive got a bright idea because they recently brought, because it's an anniversary or something like that, and they've recently brought all of the Frost Nixon tapes back to the world, and they put them out onto DVD.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
It's all been
released. So it's a marketing exercise.
So basically,
so it's a
they
giant
said,
trailer.
Let's make it. And remember that this was actually a hit West End play. A few years ago, and Michael Sheen and Frank Langella played the parts on West End, and so they've been brought
and the market
together
on the West End is totally different than the market.
So they've been brought in. Ron Howard has been brought in to make the film, and I actually quite like Ron Howard. I think he's a little bit lightweight sometimes, but he knows how to make a film, definitely.
It's just that it takes a lot to make a film, as we know from our own experience. I just look at it and I go, why did you go to all that effort? I'm just not 100% sure. You know, it seems like your energies could have been, you know.
I think if we go back and check dates, it's probably an anniversary thing.
I think it's because Frost was on.
Frost was knighted recently.
No, but he was on Jon Stewart saying, you know, the book and DVD and all that. So I'm saying to you, it's a long trailer. Long marketing trailer.
Maybe.
Okay.
Maybe. Do I think that Frank Langella will win the Oscar? No. I don't think he'll win the Oscar. No. I don't think the film is Oscar caliber. I think it was an entertaining film. I enjoyed it. I was never bored. I was quite engaged by the film. I was quite engaged by the story.
A little bit like homework, though. A little bit.
I thought Milk was more like homework.
Did you? I didn't. I thought Milk was less because I had sort of more fun.
And I enjoyed
Milk. I like more passing of time and change in the character arc.
I quite like the person.
Didn't that sound good?
that sound good.
No, because he starts out being, you know, one way and then goes another and then comes back. You know,
see, I found with Milk that those transitions were too fast. I felt that.
Well, it was only half 2 hours.
I know. I think Milk should have been a miniseries.
Yeah. I would 100% agree with you that something should be. Yes, I agree with you. That's probably true.
On that note, Frost Nixon could have been a telly movie.
Yes.
It could have been the NBC movie of the week.
How many times do we say that? We look at a film and go, why is this a film and not a
movie? That's actually a big factor. What is the deciding factor? Why is it that they look at one film and they go, this is a theatrical feature we'll throw $30 million at, and they look at another one, which is exactly the same sort of quality, and they go, oh, this will be a telly movie, we'll throw $1 million at it. I look at it and go, you look at Transformers, you look at these big films, and you sit there and go, I understand why that's going to be a feature film. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
Slumdog Millionaire is a low-budget film, but it needs that big scope.
Which is why people bought up the home theaters and stuff, because they went, some movies need to be seen in a bigger experience than a little
scope.
DVD.
Yeah. Slumdog's photography with India and Mumbai, and it's just beautiful, you know? And so you need that scope to get right in there. It's the same feeling I felt about Dominic Dunne, though, with the celebrity, the documentary. Mm. I came away from that thinking, I enjoyed the documentary. I thought it was very interesting seeing about him and everything.
But I said, why is
it at the cinema?
Yeah, exactly.
It should have been on television. Yeah. It felt like a television documentary. It didn't, in no way, shape, or form, did I feel that should have been on the cinema screens. Not quite Hollywood, needs to be on the big screen because we're seeing all those clips of all those old films. We want to see them on the big screen. Yeah. So I'm fascinated by not – there are some films where they're just obvious. You're not going to make Dark Knight for television. You're going to make that for the big screen.
Well, and on the other hand, first time we saw Star Wars, 1977, and the letters coming over, and Once Upon a Time in a Galaxy Far Away, and we get this tingle, like, oh, my God, we have to see
And then the ship flies over your head. You know? Wow. And you sit there and go, wow, that's a cinema experience. Yeah. But then, you know, the women – last year, you go, why is this on the big screen? Yeah, you know,
why is this on at all?
Well, there is that. All right.
And can I just say, if you haven't seen the original, get a copy of the original Women, because it's pretty
absolutely
bloody fantastic.
We go from a film that is considered a classic, George Cukor masterpiece film.
And Russell.
And Russell, and there's a word for women like you that you don't normally hear outside of the kennel. And all of a sudden, it's a wonderful film, and we go to a remake where the entire cast has been nominated for a Razzie.
And can't move their faces. And speaking of things that make you go, can I just say a little grumpy thing?
Things that make you go,
can I just say, hello, people out there doing award show. You fucking twats. Can you please make up your minds about what the fuck is a supporting actor and what the fuck is a lead actor? I am so sick of seeing this. I could just spit. I think it's about time we had to have a change. Because Kate Winslet wins in The Reader. She wins for supporting actress and is up for nomination supporting actress in the Golden Globes and wins for lead actress in the SAG Awards. I'm sorry. What the fuck? And then now she's nominated for an Oscar in the supporting actress category.
All right, so what I suggest is we get rid of the supporting actress category altogether and supporting actor, and instead we just have two best actor and two best actresses.
Because it's utterly ridiculous.
I also don't understand the concept of supporting. There was actually a wonderful, I can't remember who said it, but there was a wonderful comment made the year Broadcast News came out.
Yeah.
And they actually said Albert Brooks has been nominated for best supporting actor, and the person said, supporting actor, if that means supporting the entire film.
Yes, exactly.
It's like, why was he up for supporting actor when he was the star of the film?
And when Heath Ledger walks away with Batman, how do you call him the supporting actor?
Yeah.
This makes no sense.
So I think we should just get rid of the word supporting.
You hear me? You're twats. You're twats. Do something. It's ridiculous.
The last 20 odd minutes or so have been so entertaining. I may have to just cut the entire first half of the show
off. Well, I'm feeling very grumpy and hot today. You have to close the studio up, and I get hot, and I just can't stand it.
I hate logic
vacuum.
At least it's not as hot as last week, all right? All right, look, we're going to bring this to a close.
What about my masturbation story?
Oh, okay. Well, you weren't here during the news section.
Do you have it here?
I brought all the stories.
I just thought it was so cute.
Is it this one?
I think, and it's for you men out there. Women don't masturbate, as we all know, and we don't like the.
rubbish!
We don't even like the thought of it. No, this isn't it.
I'm looking.
So it's such a weird thing. All these years of feminism and stuff like that, and it's a bit like what Queen Victoria said about lesbians. Oh, women wouldn't do that. So women don't have to worry about being tarred with masturbation. But I just thought we've been hearing recently.
That's everything off the board.
The directors.
Well, you tell us about it, and I'll go out to the board
still stuck out there. Okay, well, they've been doing these studies for a while now and saying to men, you really need to clean yourself out by masturbating at least a couple of times a week to help prevent prostate cancer, which is...
There you go. Fell off the board.
Okay.
There you go.
And so, all right, we've accepted that. That's fine. But now, this is the first sentence caught my eye. Masturbation may be good for you.
Good.
Or bad.
Uh-oh.
Depending on your age.
Uh-oh. I'm 42. What's that?
Okay. Well,
I'm 41.
They're saying by the time men reach their 50s, it may protect against the disease because it helps remove toxins. I love that. They build up over a lifetime. If this is true, then every Catholic priest in the world is either fooling us or he's got prostate cancer.
I think we know the answer.
All right. It's linked with an increased risk of prostate cancer when practiced frequently by young men in their 20s and 30s. Oh, I guess you 40s are safe. I don't know. All right. So what they're saying... It makes me laugh because what it says is more than 400 men with prostate cancer diagnosed before the age of 60 were questioned about their sexual habits, and the results were compared with 400 controls. So 400 men who were told they weren't allowed to masturbate. Don't you love this? I mean, how could you trust them, right?
Well, this is just the most ridiculous thing
I know, exactly. And so what they're saying is, but this is what got me, that masturbation has a greater impact on prostate cancer either by increasing or reducing the risk. So either or. We don't really know.
So they really don't know anything.
But, no, I know. But it's not the same if you have sex. So what it says is, get this. I can't even
This is
understand.
The most convoluted, weird thing you've ever read
I
me.
Know, but listen to this. Okay. A possible explanation, this is the final paragraph, for the protective effect that men in their 50s appear to receive from overall sexual activity, and particularly masturbation, is the release of accumulated toxins. However, they're saying that it's not necessarily with sex. That you should be doing your masturbation. So it's like they're saying, when you're in your 20s, do your sex, and then when you're in your 40s, do your masturbation. So all I could think was, it's now getting...
So I'm not allowed to have sex anymore.
I don't know. It seems to me that everybody out there should look it up on the internet, because I think you're going to be needing a plan for your masturbation.
Like a schedule.
A schedule. It's seeming to become more complicated than just getting your hand out. So I think I think that rather than just go blind, you might increase your risk of prostate cancer.
So we might actually need the services of the boys of Porn Plus Plus with their reviews.
Well, exactly. Because
they can tell us what to
exactly
watch.
And there may be a time when you shouldn't be masturbating, you should be having sex. Now, I thought orgasm was orgasm. Evidently, it's not.
I didn't think it made a difference.
I don't understand
how it actually occurs.
This was the funniest thing I've ever read. So,
and who published this? Do we know?
I don't know. So perhaps, I don't know. I have to... I don't. Isn't that terrible? I didn't. You know what I'll do? Would you like me to do some research for
you? Yeah, I'd like you to do some
research.
I'll
come back with a graph.
Can you come back?
And I'll tell you out there.
Oh, and you got to bring it back next week, because we got Katrina on the show next week. And that ought to be
all right. Okay. And women, I guess you're okay. I guess you know, there's no toxins to build up
our nodder. Well, because women don't masturbate, remember?
Well, but even if they do, I guess they don't need a schedule. So it's okay. So I'll let you men know, because I know I've probably made a few men out there anxious now, wondering if they're supposed to be having sex or masturbation. Maybe what you should do is kind of just put a hold on it, so to speak, at the moment, and just
I don't think you should say put a hold on it. I think that's a terrible way of it. On that note, we're going to finish this up.
I'm good with my public service announcements, though, aren't I? Come on. You need those.
All right. We wish Jake all the best on his drive between Melbourne and Sydney.
Yes.
Nice, safe trip, and get back to us. Miren, thank you for joining me for the last...
thank you for having me. Thank you for being here.
Back to work. When's your deadline?
Oh,
tomorrow?
I don't know. Yeah.
Anyway. And in the meantime... we're going to finish up with one of the Oscar-nominated songs. Actually, this is the end credits.
They're always terrible.
No, actually, I love this song. And I don't think I'd sit there and listen to it in my living room, but for the film, for the finale of the film, it is perfect. This is from Slumdog Millionaire. It's very Indian. You're going to hate it.
It's very
Bollywood, actually. Yeah.
Has it got sitar?
I think so. Anyway, but we're going to finish with this. In the meantime, go see more movies. You don't see enough movies, and all of life's questions are answered in the movies, and I got the goddamn thing right.
Okay.
And we will talk to you next week.
शामी आने के तले आजा जरी वाले नीले आजमाने के तले
जय हो
आजा आजा जिंदे शामी आने के तले आजा जरी वाले नीले आजमाने के तले
We'll be right back.